Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh,
you're in the madhouse now.
Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber, and I want to wish you and your family a very happy holiday season and a peaceful and healthy new year. I also want to take this opportunity to thank you very much for all your support. This has been a great year for us, and I'm really excited about all the cool new things we'll be doing next year and all the great guests we already have lined up. We'll actually be dropping episode number 400 of fresh new content coming up soon on January 15th, and I never could have done this without you, so thanks. This last week of December 2018, and also next week, the first week of January 2019, I'm taking some time off. During this time, we'll be rebroadcasting some of the most popular episodes of Everyone Loves Guitar. In addition, at the beginning of each of these shows, I'm going to give you some brief commentary about my recollection of the overall interview experience I had with whatever individual we're airing that day. Again, sincere thanks for listening and for all your support. If you ever want to get a hold of me, go to the contact tab on everyonelovesguitar.com website. I'm fairly inundated with email, to be honest with you, and with work in general. So while I may not be able to answer your specific message, I do read all the messages and comments I get. Thanks again for your support. Now let's get busy with today's show. Today's rebroadcast is with one of the most popular players I've spoken to, Jack Pearson. If you don't know Jack, he played with the Allman Brothers for 3 years. He's also played with Albert King. He's played a lot with Tommy Emmanuel and still does play with Tommy. A couple of things I remember about this interview. First of all, Jack is a very shy person, if I remember correctly. And he's also incredibly humble. I mean, he's the guy in Nashville. Now, bear in mind, I've interviewed, oh gosh, probably 100 or more people in Nashville, and deservedly so. That is like the talent there is ridiculous. But Jack's the guy everybody says, oh, but did you interview Jack Pearson? Because he is the guy everybody looks up to. Wonderful player. His passion for guitar is incredible. I mean, he's the night before, you know, I think our interview is probably sometime during the day, but he was telling me he was up till 4 a.m. the night before. Like, he just plays guitar all the time. I mean, day after day after day. So there are a few guys like that that I've interviewed. I mean, everybody's obviously passionate about guitar, but there are a few guys that are, their passion is, it's like breathing for them. And Jack's definitely one of them. He's got a real sad story about why he had to leave the Allman Brothers, which basically had to do with, it's not really a spoiler. I mean, you need to listen to it to hear the whole thing, but he had hearing issues. And, you know, he's standing there next to Dickie Betts night after night, and Dickie's got 2 or 3 Marshall cabinets and Marshall amps dimed night after night, and he just couldn't take it. And the doctor said, if you don't stop and leave, you're not going to have any hearing, which obviously he didn't want to have, he'd destroy his whole career and his ability to play. So it was really kind of a sad story about what happened. But, you know, he's played with Leroy Parnell, which he talks about a story in there, because I had interviewed Leroy. And Leroy talked about how he first met Jack, and Jack sort of corrects Leroy's version of that story. He's played with Derek. He's played with Warren Haynes. He also plays like an $87 Squire Strat. So for everybody who thinks, you know, the tone is in the guitar, clearly the tone is in your hand. And, you know, of course, I think Jack's at a level where he could do whatever he wants on any guitar, whether it's an $87 guitar, $87,000 guitar. He's going to sound like Jack no matter what. And I've met Jack in person a couple of times after that. Very sweet guy, extremely humble. And like I said, he's a shy person, very kind. And for the amount of talent he has, he's so unassuming, it's amazing. So I think you're going to like this interview. Enjoy it. Let me know.
I'm ready.
Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I am with, by everybody I've spoke to in Nashville has said to me, you know, have you spoke to Jack Pearson, because he's the best guitar player in Nashville? And I say that not like, and I know Jack's not a guy that brags, but literally like 25 guitar players, great guitar players, I said, you got to get Jack Pearson on your show. He's the best guitar player in Nashville. So the universe smiled on me today, and I am here with the one and only amazing Jack Pearson. He's not only an A-list blues rock lead and slide guitarist, he's also a soulful, creative songwriter and a really good solo artist in his own right, and he truly has been there and done that. During his colorful career, he's mastered a wide range of instruments, including electric, slide, acoustic, and resonated guitar, mandolin, old-time banjo, and Hammond organ, which he incorporates into many musical styles, such as blues and roots music, jazz and bebop, pop and rock, and bluegrass and country. His versatility and musicianship keeps his live shows and recordings fresh and exciting. And I got to tell you, his enthusiasm for playing guitar is unrivaled to anybody. I mean, this guy, you know, the guitar is like, you know, air for Jack, I'd say. Jack was a member of the Allman Brothers Band from 1997 to 1999. He's worked with music legends from the world of jazz, rock, blues, and country, including the Allman Brothers, Greg Allman, Vince Gill, Jimmy Buffett, Tommy Emmanuel, Joe Bonamassa, Charlie Daniels, Keb Moe, Delbert McClinton, Earl Scruggs, Bobby Blue Bland, Mac McAnally out of Muscle Shoals, Amy Grant, Ronnie Millsap, Jimmy Hall, Warren Haynes, Government Mule, Derek Trucks, T. Graham Brown, Bonnie Bramlett, Leroy Parnell, who I interviewed in episode 175, Martina McBride, Taj Mahal, Trace Atkins, Dr. John, Sam Moore, John Hyatt, Tedeschi Trucks. I mean, literally, the list goes on and on. I had to trim it or we never would have gotten through the interview. But anyway, Jack, I really I really appreciate your time and coming on the show, man.
You know, what a banker would say, look at all those people you work for. You can't keep a job, can you?
I guess he might.
And that would be true.
Well, hey, I want to fix a story. When I interviewed Leroy Parnell in episode 175, he had a very long, interesting story about how the two of you all met. And it was very detailed and very specific, but I have a funny feeling there might have been some parts that it misconstrued. So I wanted you to clear it up.
Yeah, a couple of guys sent me a link to that, and most of it's right. But we didn't go to Texas the day after we met. He was playing in a band called Renegade, and I'd heard they were in town. And I was already playing in two bands. I was in a band called Mr. Lucky and another one called Southbound. And anyhow, I went up after a gig to hear them, and there was some people in the audience who were like, let Jack play. And, you know, all my life I've always went and sat in with people, you know, and they were kicking butt, man, so I wanted to play with them. And I got up there, I thought I'd play one or two songs, and I played the rest of the night. And we just hit it off really great. But they were all living in Murfreesboro. Owen and his wife, they had a young child, and used to go over and visit them. Leroy, he was up in Yuna. And we played around town for a couple of months, and they got a gig down in Florida. It was a two-week gig. So they had to get permission from my parents for me to go, because I was 17. You know, I couldn't leave the state without permission. And he did come over to the house and talk to my daddy. And he did. He sat in that chair watching, you know, smoking them cigarettes. He smoked pebbles. But Leroy, he talked for 30 minutes, you know.
That's so hard to believe.
Yeah, well, but, you know, I was really shy back then, so I didn't talk much. But I talk a blue streak now. But anyhow, after Leroy finished, you know, telling him, you know, we'll take care of him, watch out for him, all this stuff. And he said, my dad told my mom, well, he's going to go, so we might as well let him. So I thought that was cool. You know, he's like, he knew I was going to go, didn't want me to run away from home, you know. So the band, we loaded up and the gig was canceled.
Oh, my Lord, you're kidding.
I thought Leroy would have thrown that in the story because it's so funny. We drove around all around that area trying to find a club that would let us play. And there's a picture of the club we landed at. And in fact, Leroy put it on Instagram last week. We loaded in his Marshall amp, and I had a Bandmaster head with 212 cabinet. And these old fishermen were sitting at the bar, and they turned around and said, "You're not going to plug those up, are you?" And anyhow, we played. We all moved down there. We ended up staying down there for like 9 months. And we had a house gig in Panama City, and we played all through that Gulf. And we would go up into Alabama. And but eventually, we moved back to Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and we had a band house. And that's when Leroy went back to Texas. And then, so that was in 78. We met in 77, the fall of 77. And then in 1979, I moved to Austin. So Leroy and I started another band. So that was 2 years later. Cool.
So you left home at 17 pretty much and never came back.
Well, I came back a few times, you know. After Renegade broke up, I stayed down in Florida and Mississippi and played with a couple of different bands and then came back to Tennessee. And then I went to Muscle Shoals, came back to Tennessee. I always kept coming back here, you know. And Leroy called and said he had some work out in Texas. Did I know any bass players? So I asked Pete McLaren, and we loaded up the car and went to Texas. And I stayed out there. That was in August of 79, and I came back the next summer. But that's when we went and played New York and Colorado. We did a lot of traveling around in that van.
So you were with Leroy when he went up and played with Kinky?
Yeah, I was a Texas Jew boy.
Oh.
So that's when I moved to Texas to
okay.
do that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I get it.
And then when Kinky thing fell apart, Leroy and I, we got a different drummer and bass player and a keyboard player. No, the same bass player, Pete, because he went out there with me. And then we started that second band. And we had, eventually we got two background singers, two girls, and that was enough for me. That's when I split.
That's a big band. Yeah, man. That's a lot of
people. It was, you know. Yeah, and we struggled, you know. We had a good time playing, but it was a struggle. And those were weird times, man, because you had disco and punk rock happening, and we're still trying to play Southern rock.
Yeah. Well, you're cutting that pie pretty small with all the members, too. You got a small pie to begin with, and you're cutting it in 12 slices instead of 4 or 5.
I remember seven of us sleeping in one hotel room. Yeah.
Wow.
We just didn't have any money, you know. We had to save what we had to drive to the next state or whatever.
Sure, sure.
But we did it. We made through, and we played our hearts out. And, you know, Leroy and I, we played together a couple of weeks ago. We did a tribute to Greg Allman and Butch Trucks.
That's very cool.
And, yeah.
Well, thanks for clearing that up.
We still play great together, you know. We've always played good together. I love it. We're talking about doing something new.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would be really good. Yeah.
I told him, I said, people just want to hear us jam, man. You know, we'll just go out there and jam, have fun.
See what comes of it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for clearing up that story, man.
Well, it's just my side.
The revised Jack Pearson version. So, hey, let me ask you, you have had a very robust career is an understatement, but I was curious for these three artists, if you could talk about maybe how you got the gig and what the gig was, and then maybe a cool story about working with them. And if there's happened to be anything specific you learned from the experience, although I got a funny feeling you're the kind of guy that you learn something everything you do.
Yes.
But talk about the Allman Brothers Band.
My favorite band when I was growing up. I learned every note they played on those early records. And so did Leroy, you know. So when we met, we were like, hey, we know how to do this. Mm-hmm. So I was friends with Warren Haynes. He used to live here in Nashville in the 80s. Mm. And we played together and jammed. And one night he pulled me over to the side. He said, hey, Jack, I just joined the Allman Brothers. It's like, that's great. You know, if you ever need a sub, let me know.
That's the only answer a smart man would give. Yeah.
Well, that's just my sense of humor, you know. But, you know, and we're still friends to this day. And that was in 88, maybe. Yeah, 88. And in 93, he called. He said, Dickie's got to leave the tour. Come out and play. So I did. And Greg took a shine to me and liked my songs. He heard a cassette tape of some of my songs and invited me out to his house to write. And that meant so much to me, man, I'll tell you. And to have Greg Allman call me and say, hey, bro. You know, so after Dickie came back, I started playing with Greg's solo band, Greg Allman and Friends. Because he said, man, I hate to see you go. Come play with my band. I was like, yes, please.
Yeah.
And so then I did that for, that started in 93. So in 97, Greg called and asked me if I wanted to join the Allman Brothers. And it took me like a split second to say yes. And that was unbelievable. And then I started having hearing damage. I'd already started getting some ringing in my ears, but playing with Dickie, the stage volume was very high. And I was wearing custom-made plugs, but it was still over the threshold of you know, the plugs bring it down to a certain level, but I think from what I've read, anything over 80 or 85 dB can cause damage. And so, yeah, it was way up there. Most of the time he used 200 watt Marshalls and sometimes three.
Holy crap. It was loud.
Most of the time, Dickie wasn't in the PA mains most of the time. You know, his fader out front was off. Hmm. It was coming off the stage, which is fine. I mean, I always love to play live too, but I just couldn't, my eardrums couldn't handle it. So it was one of the hardest things I had to do. I had to tell him I had to leave the band.
Wow.
The last shows we played were at the Beacon. We did 21 shows in a row in 1999, and I think, and 98 or 99. We was up there for 5.5 weeks. I remember that. We rehearsed for a week and then started playing the shows. But that last week after I had to turn in my notice, man, you know, I was in tears every night trying to get through the show. It was traumatic. But anyhow, what a blessing it was to get to do that. And, you know, was in a band with J-Mo last year called Libraires, you know. It was five of us that were in the Brothers, Butch and J-Mo and Mark and O'Till and me. And then we brought in Lamar Williams to sing and Pat Bergeson to play guitar and Bruce Katz to play keyboards. And it was really smoking.
When you first got in the Allman Brothers, Jack, was it like surreal almost?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's like you try to be cool, but I'm still a kid, you know.
Yeah.
Greg and I became really good friends, and we spent a lot of one-on-one time together on the road, right? But still, when he would call me and I'd get on the phone and hear that voice, I'd like revert back to a 12-year-old, you know, my hero's calling me. It was like weird.
Yeah, you know? No, I could totally understand that.
Yeah, you know, and I told Dickie one day, I said, man, he used to be my biggest hero, you know, it's like freaky playing, you know, and he said, I understand, you know, because he played with some of his heroes too. Mm. Yeah. But, you know, so you, you got to be, it's a mental challenge. It was for me because all these guys that I got to play with, I didn't dream of playing with any of them. You know, I'm just working on my playing, trying to get better and showing up for the gig. And then you get to play with them and it's like you have to be one of the guys.
You know. Was that hard to be one of the, I mean, as a young kid, you know, you weren't, that was probably difficult. Like it probably took you a bit of time, I would imagine.
I think I had the hardest problem with Dickie and Greg because, you know, I looked up to them so much, you know, and, but get to stand over there by Greg all those years and man, his organ playing was, he had played these funky rhythms, man. It was really cool. Yeah. A lot of it didn't make it into the mix, you know, so I would stand back there by his Leslie and play rhythm with him, you know, and Dickie'd be out there just soaring, man. You know, he had some really good nights where he just took off. And just to sit there and watch that and play rhythm with Greg and J-Mo, oh, man, what a good memory.
Yeah, it's probably a fantasy. What did you do? How long did it take you, like when you stopped there, when you had to leave the band, how long did it take you to like figure out what you're going to do next or till you could even do anything next with your hearing?
I kind of disappeared for a couple of years. You know, I played around locally. I'd do a session every once in a while. And I still have the ringing, you know, it's still bad. I have to wear earplugs all the time. But I'm just trying to protect my ears so they won't get worse.
Yeah, sure.
You know, Dickie and Butch, they pretty much lost their hearing, and I don't want to end up like that.
Did you have to put – sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Did you have to ever push yourself to, like – not convince yourself, but, like – I would imagine it took some determination and persistence to stay playing music.
No, I can't breathe if I can't play music. You know,
yeah.
I stayed up to 4 o'clock last night playing my guitar here by myself. And I do that most nights.
Yeah.
I remember, I don't know, I guess I was about 20 years old and Leroy, he came in the kitchen and said, "What the hell are you doing, man? It's 4 a.m. I'm like, "I'm trying to learn a new guitar lick." So I've always done that, you know. And my folks used to holler at me because I'd be in my bedroom playing all the time. And my mom, before she passed away, a couple of years before she passed away, she told me, she said, "You were a pretty good kid until you saw a toy guitar in the grocery store." You wanted it so bad, you threw a fit till I got it for you. So I guess I wanted to play it before I can even remember, you know. And my oldest brother, he was 18 years older than me. So when I was born, he got married and moved away and had a couple of kids. And he came over to visit. I think I was about 8 or 9 years old. We lived way out in the country. He came over with a guitar and showed me how to play a couple of Jimmy Reed licks and a G chord, and that did it for me. And you know, I wasn't able to get a guitar for a few years. I think I was about 12.
Oh wow.
He came over and left an old acoustic with action like a dobro. You know, we've all heard that story about and calling guitars a finger bleeder.
Yeah,
right. My fingers really did bleed.
Yeah.
I played that thing. It was so hard to play, and my fingers actually bled. So it's a true story. But, you know, I'd been playing for a little while, and he bought me a little Tiesco guitar, electric. And I played on that for a while and started begging my mama for another guitar. And she got me an Aria Les Paul copy. It was black, like a custom. And I played that. I've always traded guitars, you know. I only had that one guitar, so if I wanted something different, I'd have to trade it, and then I traded that.
Sure.
I traded that for a – I got a pretty good memory. I can remember all these guitars and stuff.
Yeah, your memory is real good, actually. Did you party a lot? Were you a partier ever? You don't seem so
– Oh,
you were, and you just got a good memory.
Yeah, I'm sure we all block out some things, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that little black guitar, I played that thing, and we were doing a show at the Ag Center, and there was a guy there with an Electra, Les Paul copy, and it was Sunburst. It was actually a better guitar. But he said, I'll trade you this for that black guitar. It sounds so good. I said, I played it. I was like, well, heck yeah. You know, so I traded him. And that upset my mama, but I couldn't help it. And then later on, I traded that for an SG. So when I was about 16 or 17, I had a SG. And that's what I was playing when I first met Leroy.
With that SG?
And then the SG, yeah.
You still have
that?
It
was a good guitar. You know, and I wanted a Les Paul so bad, you know. And I traded it for a Les Paul that was probably a worse guitar. I probably should have kept the SG. And then I traded it for a 335. That was a good one. Mm. It was a mid-60s 335. And,
You started with a little copy guitar, and then you got a worked your way up to a Gibson 335. Well, that's you're a pretty shrewd guy who trading.
You know what? There was a man named Pinky Davis, and he was in Shelbyville, Tennessee, which is like 20 miles from where I grew up. It's about 50 miles from Nashville. It was called the Shelbyville Record Shop, and he helped so many musicians get instruments. He helped me get my very first Fender amp. My friend Avent Lane drove me down there. I didn't have a driver's license. And there was blackface Fender amps lining the whole wall. Take your pick for $200. And I didn't know what to get, you know. And the guy that was with me said, I think you ought to get this Super Reverb. So I got that. I couldn't even put it in the car. I was too little to lift it. But Mr. Davis, he let me pay him $30 a month till I paid it off.
Wow.
And he worked out a deal where I could get that SG. That's where I got the SG. That's where I got the Les Paul. That's where I got the 335. That's where I got my first jazz bass. Let's see. He helped me get so many amps. I got that amp. It got stolen. Renegade, the band Leroy and I were in. We were playing two nights at a club, and we went in the second day, and my amp was gone. Somebody stole it. And it was a really nice blackface Super Reverb. It was like brand new back then. Of course, it was only 10 years old, or, you know, 12 years old. And so I went back down to Mr. Davis's and told him, man, somebody stole my amp. He said, well, get one of these, you know. So I got a blackface Bandmaster with a 212 cabinet, and we put EVs in the cabinet. That thing sounded so good. I ended up trading that head for a Marshall head, but I kept the cabinet. I wish I still had that cabinet. It was a good sounding cabinet. And I don't know. I probably got a half a dozen amps and guitars from Mr. Davis through the years. He was really helpful. He actually helped me get my very first Porta studio to do some home recording. Mm. So he helped me get into all of that too. And now I've got all this Pro Tools stuff. Mm. Yeah, he passed away a couple of years ago. He had Alzheimer's. Man, he helped so many people.
It's kind of sad.
A lot of us in this area, we wouldn't be the players we are. I mean, Adrian Ballou was around here. I went to see him play. He was in a band called Sweetheart and used to go see him play before Frank Zappa got him, right?
Wow.
And he used to play dances. We'd go out and hear him, you know, and he would play slide every once in a while, and he would play it over the top of the neck. I was like, man, just think of what you could do if you could hold it like this. So I was like really the only serious slide player around, and that's when Leroy showed up. And I was at the music store, and they said, hey, man, there's a guy from Texas that's playing slide, too. I said, well, I got to hear this, you know. And so that's when we bonded. I went out to hear him and jammed with him.
It's kind of one, you know, you don't think about it, but the guys like that are no longer around, that you can't have a business like that anymore because of economics.
Right.
That's kind of sad because in the smaller towns, which is most of the country, that doesn't exist. It's really hard.
Yeah. He was a saint, man. I'm telling you what.
That's cool, man.
There was so many good players in my area. I grew up in Murfreesboro. When the high school I went to, I dropped out. I don't want to promote that, but there was four or five good guitar players. Forrest York, he's still playing. Tom Maxwell, he passed away. Man, we were in a couple of bands together. And we had Scott Lane on bass, Abe White on bass. He's playing with Bad Company now. And Craig James, he was a good bluegrass player. Lee Tenpenny, man, he was great. Roy Davenport, that's some good pickers. You know. And we just had a little reunion and a birthday party for Norris Haynes. I learned a lot playing with him, and he's 71. And we had a surprise for him last week. He showed up at the community center with his amp in one hand and his guitar in the other.
Nice.
He thought he was going to a gig. And we're like, happy birthday.
That's pretty cool, man. And he had a good time, yeah. I'm sure.
He did. We played, and I learned a chord from him. I learned something from him every time I played with him. And I got him a card and thanked him for showing me his licks, you know.
Nice.
And Ray Rice was there, great keyboard player. And Phil was there too, the drummer, and they were both asking me, do you remember when we used to sneak you in clubs? I said, man, I tell those stories all the time.
Because you were too underage.
Yeah.
Hey, talk.
But, you know, I started playing gigs when I was 14 or 15. So they would sneak me in the club, and sometimes I'd have to stay backstage until time to play. And then they'd bring me up on stage and I'd play, and then they'd make me go back, you know. And some places were looser. I tried to be a good boy, though.
Talk about learning licks. You played with Derek. I saw him play a show down here at the Blues Festival. He closed out a set. He closed out an encore with a Bob Dylan song called Down in the Flood. And, he did some. I've been to 100 concerts or more. I was with my older son. And after, that show, I said, I literally couldn't talk. I'd never seen that happen. And how did that gig come out with you playing with him? Because that's between the two of you guys, you're that same kind of guy.
Well, I'm quite a bit older than him. I'll be 58 soon. And he was 14 when I met him. So I met him on the first solo tour I did with Greg Allman. That was in 1994. And Derek was opening the shows. And we always played together. And I remember on some of the shows with the brothers, I toured with Warren first, and then I toured with Dickie, and then later on I toured with Derek. So I got to do the Allman Brothers with all three of those dudes. Mm. But, Derek was always just watching my hands like a hawk. And one night I said, don't you forget where you're getting this. He said, I won't. But, he's got so much talent. And, he was playing pretty much like he does now when he was 14.
Wow.
I kind of had my style happening when I was a teenager too. There's several licks that people call signature licks of mine. I made them up, when I was a teenager. And I was working on this little double stop stuff, where you use a third and a seventh of a chord. And when you move it to a different string or down a fret, it becomes the four chord, but it flip-flops. So the third is on the bottom or the seventh is on the top or whatever. And so I've been working on that. I found that when I was about 14, I guess. And when I was about 20, I ran into Lenny Bro, and he's doing all that stuff. And he's adding these high notes with his pinky. It's like, dang, it is okay to do that, because nobody else was doing it, it's easy to second guess yourself, when you're stumbling on something. I remember trying to learn a Wes Montgomery thing when I was about 15 and kept thinking, this can't be right. And then 10 years later, after I learned a bunch of chord voicings, I'm like, that was right. but it's, there wasn't any instruction stuff back then, finally got the Mel Bay Chord Encyclopedia. That helped me a lot. Ted Green had come out with his book, but, you know, it was so fast I couldn't. It scared me, you know, 10,000 chords or something.
Yeah.
Like, I think I'll have to wait on that.
Wow. I know you got a couple of things going on now that you're pretty excited about. You want to talk about them? Your two records coming out?
Yeah. I've got an R&B record coming out. I call it an R&B record. It's kind of a variety of things, but some of the tracks I started, I think four of the songs I recorded in the 90s, I just never did release them. And I dug them out and I was like, man, this fits in with what I'm doing on this new thing. So it's like tracks from 20 years. And I'm very happy with it, very proud of it. And then I've got a live record coming out. I say record, CD, with my band, with Charles Treadway and Joshua Hunt. It's my favorite thing I've done live with the band. Charles is playing B3 and kicking bass, and I just love that sound and the freedom it gives you. And Josh is the best drummer ever, man. And we just do things. We don't rehearse. We just improvise. Jazz players. I'm jazz player, but we're playing funk and southern rock and all kind of stuff. And we've been together for, 5 or 6 years now. And when they first started playing with me, I told them, I said, now, this isn't going to be what you're used to. You know, I mean, I'm going to go from Roy Buchanan and Jimi Hendrix to Wes Montgomery and Django Reinhardt within, you know, 8 bars. And sound-wise and stylistic-wise, you know, with some Charlie Parker licks thrown in. And so it took them a while to get used to that, you know. But I never told them anything what to do, just play with your heart. And it's really developed into, I think it's something unique. So I'm very proud of that, too. Just finished mixing it and starting to work on the graphics.
Where was that recorded?
In January.
No, where? Look, you said it was live.
Here in Nashville, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, you've been involved in so many different projects. If you had, and that's probably a hard question, maybe even unfair, but if you had to, like, say, what were the top three experiences for you in looking back so far, you know, musically? Like, which ones left you most satisfied musically?
You know what? Being satisfied musically is hard because you're always pushing yourself to be better, you know. I just played with Tommy Emmanuel. We've played together a bunch over the last few years, but we've played together, half a dozen times in the last 6 months, and it's just incredible. So that's a big highlight for me. Of course, the Allman Brothers. And, but man, I got to play with some of these jazz guys, man. Buddy DeFranco and Jimmy Smith and Groove Holmes and Jimmy Rainey. I mean, Mundell Lowe. I first saw his name on a Charlie Parker record, right? And ran into him. We did a jazz festival together. This was back in the 80s. And, wow, getting to play with him and you know, those guys were so nice. And, I was just amazed that Jimmy Rainey wanted to play with me, you know, because those records he did with Stan Getz. I mean, Mundell and Jimmy, they were two of the first guys to play bebop on the guitar, you know. Charlie Christian started it, and then they came along, and Tal Farlow and Barney Kessel, all those guys. So, I don't know. That's very important to me to be around and watch them play, the way they would touch the strings and stuff. But they're not beating on the instrument. They're, you know, getting a good sound out of it. Man, you know, I got to meet Earl Scruggs. I played mandolin on a song with him, you know, and I've got, he signed that picture for me. I got it on my wall. There.
Yeah, I see that, man.
Anyhow, what a tone out of a banjo. And he what a groove, you know. Of course, I'm into so many different styles. I love playing mandolin and that old time banjo stuff. Jimmy Hendrix, you name it.
Do you ever sit back and like allow yourself to, like when someone says, "Hey, man, you really kicked ass tonight," do you allow yourself to take that in ever, or is it always like, "Thanks, but I'm on," you know, "I need to make sure I get to the next notch."
I used to not be, now I just say thank you, I'm glad you enjoyed it. But Thelonious Monk had the best line. When somebody would compliment him, he would say, "You should have heard what I was trying to play."
That's awesome, man. I'm going to write that down. That is killer. That is freaking that excellent. Great? Yeah.
Yeah.
You should have heard what I was Milt trying Jackson, to play.
Milt Jackson, when he passed away, he wanted a quote on the news. And it was from Charlie Parker. And Charlie Parker told him, "I don't care how good you play tonight, go home and practice."
Sure.
You know. Those guys believe in keeping getting better. And that's why I always just wanted to be a better musician. I'm always trying to learn something new. It's weird, man. It's like you can just play two notes sometimes and it sounds like you've never heard them before. For me.
Sure.
It hasn't always been like this. Maybe it's because I'm heading towards my second childhood.
No, it's probably because you're like you know, like a lot of guys I've talked to, and it's I think it's just some of it's age, you know, because you start the number. Like I often have a question I ask people of, what's been the biggest change for you in the last 10 years, and inevitably the answer is often some version of, you know what, man, I'm okay with me. And I wonder if maybe that's part of it. Like, you know, you're okay with playing those two notes now, like enjoying those two notes where you might not have been in the past. I don't know.
Well, I've worked for being a side man. You get in all kinds of situations and sometimes it's musically rewarding at all. It's just work, right?
Sure.
So you do the best you can and try not to get too depressed about it. And, it's just a job. But a few years ago, I got it back, and I tell people this. You ever see a little kid reach up and pluck a guitar string, and it goes ding, and you go, "Wow, you can make music with that." I got back to that a few years ago. So it's, and Tommy Emmanuel's the same way. I went down to play with him last weekend, and we got to the venue at 2:30, and we started playing backstage at 3:00. And we played, except for stopping to eat, we played till 9:00 when he went on stage. He just wanted to play the whole time. And I said, "Don't you want to go take a nap before the show?" He's like, "No, man, let's play."
So he's got that same enthusiasm and passion that you do.
He does.
Yeah.
David Greer, you know David Greer, the great bluegrass player? First time I met him, we jammed for 6 hours. The next time, we jammed for 9 hours.
Holy crap.
You know.
Wow.
Fingers were so sore the next day. And David, he's got these huge calluses on his fingertips. I mean, he just plays all the time. Brian Sutton, the same way. I know horn players. You know. Charlie Parker said they almost got evicted, you know, because he played his horn 10 and 15 hours a day.
Yeah, that I've read.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So it's not just me. There's a famous quote with the classical cellist Pablo Casals.
Sure.
When he was 90, they asked him, "Why are you practicing?" And he said, "I think I'm onto something. I think I'm getting the hang of this, you know? Finally getting the hang." But, you know, so as a musician, you want to try to keep that. I've met so many guys that get their playing to a certain level where they can make money with it. And they just stay there, and that's fine. That's not what I want to do, you know.
So you just want to constantly get better and learn new stuff and improve on the instrument, and you just have a very strong drive to keep getting better on that.
Yeah. When I was about 20 or 21, I went to Miami for the first time, and That was after I split Texas. I went back to Tennessee and went to muscle shows and ended up down in Miami. And I met these Cubans and Jamaicans. And there was this one guy from the islands. I don't remember where, but he played this big old arch top. And he just played without a pick. And he had the prettiest rhythm, man. And he just kind of stroked the strings. And it just sounded so good. And being around those guys, man, and some of those percussionists, I always loved those rhythms. And so anyhow, just learning from whoever I could.
Sure.
And that's where I first got with Joe Orr, who was friends with J-Mo. And he was doing this double shuffle, man, on the drums. It's like, whoa, tell me what you're doing so I can tell everybody about it. So when I got back to Tennessee, I'm telling all the drummers, you got to do this, man, on the snare drum, you know. Because nobody was doing that around here. It was a different type of shuffle.
Jack, you said you're originally from Murfreesboro.
I was born in Nashville, and then my folks moved to Murfreesboro.
Which is about, 25 miles outside of Nashville?
Yeah, 30, 35, 39. Something like
that. Yeah. What was your childhood like growing up?
Typical kid. I like to shoot basketball and ride my bicycle and play in the dirt with a stick. We didn't have computers back then. Build a bridge, get some water running and make a stream, kind of creative stuff.
Yeah.
My dad was a carpenter. He played banjo. He quit playing. I only got to hear him play twice. So when I wanted to leave home, he knew what I was fixing to get into because he did the same thing.
Okay.
When he first left home, he was gone for 2 years before they heard from him. And he took a team of mules. He was born in 1913. So in the 20s or 30s, he took – yeah, I guess it was in the 30s. He took a – him and another guy took a team of mules to Arkansas.
This is from Murphy's – from Nashville or from Murphy's – where was he growing up?
He was in Murfreesboro then.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And out there where Uncle Dave Macon was from. And he was a famous bluegrass. He was like the first Opry star.
Okay.
And he played that old style of banjo. And, some good old stories. Anyhow, my dad ended up in Tupelo, Mississippi. And that's where he met my mother. That's where she was from. And she was one of 13 children.
Holy smokes.
So my dad was hanging around Uncle Dave Macon, and he used to talk about the McGee brothers and all these famous old-time musicians. You know, he was playing with those guys. And my mom, she said she remembered Elvis singing in church when he was a little boy. Wow. And the Carter family came through. And they would do a concert and then give music lessons at the school during the week. So she took from them. And I said, did you play Mama Maybelle's big old guitar? She said, oh, yeah. And I showed her a picture of it. And she said, yeah, I think that was it.
Wow. You know? So both your parents were musically involved with music.
Yeah, my mom, she sang and hummed all the time. Hmm. She took in sewing for extra money. That's how she bought me my first good guitar. She got a loan at the bank and paid it back by taking in sewing.
Sure.
And I paid her back later on, tried to do it many times over. But anyhow, she would hum all the time. She'd been there sewing and humming. And she sang really loud. I think that's where I get my loud mouth when I sing. But my dad, he quit playing for some reason. But he would always be sitting in that rocking chair smoking, and he'd be tapping his foot, and he'd get a rhythm going on the arm of the chair, and I could tell he had a good timing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother Stanley, that taught me how to play, he had really a good groove. And he was really into Chuck Berry and Carl Perkins and Lightnin' Hopkins and Ventures and all that stuff. So I heard all kind of music around the house, and anything I heard, I would try to learn it. And I started playing in bands when I was, before I could drive, the older guys would come pick me up and take me to the rehearsals and things. And so I was always in there learning whatever top 40 was. We'd play George Jones songs a Jimi Hendrix song. We'd play a Steppenwolf tune, and then we'd play a Conway Twitty song, you know, to keep the audience involved.
But back then, and that's what radio was. Back then, that's what was normal radio. Yeah. You'd hear all that stuff on radio. Back when they had before they had FM, and in the beginning of FM, same thing, man.
Yeah. Those were great songs, you know.
They just play good songs. It wasn't as segmented as it is now.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and it's amazing what you could get away with playing. You know, we'd play a Santana tune, you know, and then go into a Last Date by, you know, that old piano. I can't think of his name. But, you know, Norris and Ray Rice and them, they were in those bands, and I was so privileged to get to play with. They're still great musicians, you know. I mean, that's the guys I got to jam with a couple of weeks ago, and they're 70 now. They still play good, man, and they knew these chord voicings and stuff. And I think that's where I first heard some of that stuff.
Let me ask you this. You know, as far as tuition, you know, everybody pays tuition in your business, whatever that business is. What would you say, if you're okay, talking about one or two mistakes you might have made, the tuition, and then what you learned from them?
What mistakes I made?
Yeah, if you happen to make any. If you made any. Because I've talked to a couple of guys.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
There were some gigs that I did just out of desperation that I wish I hadn't done, you know. But, you know, a lot of them didn't pay good. I remember splitting up the money one night, and this guy came in and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm splitting up the money. This is what we made in the tip jar." And he said, "Man, I'm homeless and I made more than that tonight."
Well, I'll tell you.
You know, I mean, I remember splitting up the money one night. We made like $1.73 a piece. Yeah. So there's some lean years, man. Yeah. Everybody has to pay their dues.
You know, I interviewed Reggie Young, and Reggie was telling me when he was playing over at Muscle Shoals on all them big hits, he played on about 120 hits over there. Mm. In the beginning, he was getting $10. I said, "What, $10 a song?" He goes, "No, $10 like for the whole day if you could find him to get him to pay you."
Right.
That's just crazy.
Yeah, I've been stiffed a lot. I know guys that's always gotten paid. Man, I've gotten ripped off a bunch, and it just happens, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, and they're going to pay for it someday. But, you know, I played in places where there should have been chicken wire, you know, the Blues Brothers Center.
Yeah.
I've had bottles fly by my head on the stage and other things, and it's scary.
Yeah.
And, you know, one night we played a gig, and the drummer had drank so much that we owed the bar money, just like in the Blues Brothers.
Yeah, where was this?
Oh, I don't want to say. Anyhow, but, you know, when I saw that movie, I was like, that's my life, you know. And when I saw Spinal Tap, I was like, you know. So.
Wow.
I'm kind of glad. I hope things aren't like that anymore. I don't know.
You know, you have such a passion for guitar, and this is probably a hard question. Why? What is it that, how does that make you feel so free? Like what is it that you get out of that emotionally?
I don't know if I have words for it. It, you know, it's a spiritual thing to me, and it's so, you know, you can kind of escape your reality sometimes. You know, it makes me feel good. Sometimes when I'm playing, I'll shed a tear. You know, so I feel the emotions that the crowd feels while I'm doing it sometimes, and not all the time. I mean, I'd probably go crazy if I was that connected all the time.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to go for. When I was a teenager, I got the hint about improvising. I don't know where I picked that up. Maybe it was hearing Django and Wes and, you know, the Allman Brothers, because, you know, they didn't play it the same way every time.
Sure.
And I would hear these records with Wes and Django, and it was the same song but totally different. I'm like, And So I've always wanted to be an improviser. One of the first things I did on the guitar was just kind of, you know, mess around before I didn't know anything. But it kind of sounded okay to me. I don't remember what it was, but, you know, some things are easy to play on guitar and some things aren't. You know, some of the stuff they teach now is a harder way of doing it. You know, all these scales and modes, I don't do none of that stuff, man. Mm-hmm. I'll use the major scale and all the variations of it to warm up my fingers, but I don't want to use it musically. Sure. And I don't want to be trapped playing in modes because I heard Joe Pass say that major, minor, and dominant, those are the three families, and all the chords come out of those three families. And, you know, I started studying that, and I thought, well, that's the way I've always heard music, you know. Minor sounds mysterious or sad, and major sounds a little bit happier, you know. And the dominant, that's that bluesy stuff, you know. If you wanted blues, put that note in there. If you want it happy, you put that major seven note in there, or the six, you know. So it really is just those three families. And that made things easier for me to understand, you know, trying to teach myself music theory and everything. And some of my friends I went to school with, they went on to college and studied music. And they would, you know, we were still hanging out and playing gigs together. So they'd tell me what they were learning. I never learned to read the notation.
Sure.
But I know all the harmony and chord voicings and everything.
Jack, let's talk gear for just a couple minutes. I can't imagine how many guitars you got, but is there like what's your go-to guitar right now, and maybe what other two or three round out your top?
I have a couple of Strats that I like a lot, and they're Squires. I found them in the store, just picked them up, and they just vibrate like crazy. And I never even plugged them up in the store. I just thought, oh, I like the way this feels. You know, if the electronics aren't any good, I'll replace the pickups later, you know.
So you replaced the pickup on them?
No.
Oh, you haven't? When stock?
So when I got home and plugged them up, I'm like, hey, the pickups are good too. Rewired the bridge pickup. I changed the second tone control to the bridge pickup instead of the middle pickup. That way, if I'm in the second or fourth position, the tone controls affect, you know, the neck and middle or the bridge and middle. But I hardly ever do that. It's usually either neck or bridge pickup. And I want a tone control on that bridge pickup. It's very important. I don't know why Leo didn't put a tone control on it instead of the middle. But that's the only alter thing I do. I file the nut, set it up. I don't do any fret work, but I file my own nut and adjust the pickups right and stuff like that. And this little red guitar, the one that's in this picture up here, I found it used. And the salesman was trying to talk me out of it. I said, no, I think I want this one. And he's like, what do you want this thing for? And I said, I like it.
It's another Squire.
Yeah, it's a red Squire. It was used for $87. And it had a big old heavy metal sticker on it. Mm-hmm. And the salesman said, "What? Well, are you going to modify this?" I said, yeah, I'm going to scrape that sticker off of it.
How many Squires did you have to pick up? How many Squires did you have to pick up to find those two? Or is it like random luck?
Oh, maybe 1 out of 10.
Okay.
Would be good. But it's like that with anything.
Yeah.
You know, you pick up 10 Les Pauls, there might be one that sounds halfway decent. You know?
Sure, sure.
Yeah. It's like that with old L5s. You know, you pick up a bunch of them, they're like, clunk, you know. Just because it's a famous guitar doesn't mean it's going to be good. But main thing I look for is something that resonates. All right. So then I found this SG last month, and the whole thing vibrates. I mean, the neck, the body, it's like those Strats I play. So that's the main thing I want in a guitar that vibrates and is resonant and it's fun to play. Because I've had some guitars that you had to work to play them. I just ain't into that. I don't want a guitar fighting me.
Yeah, yeah.
Some guys say they want a guitar to fight them, but that's usually the guys that don't have much technique. The guys with technique, Tommy Emmanuel's guitar is so easy to play, man. That's why you can play on it.
Yeah.
I bet you Steve Vai's guitar is easy to play.
Yeah, you would think.
You know, I mean.
No, I don't get that when guys say, I like a guitar that fights me. Whatever. To me, it's hard enough to play. Why, you know, it's like having a relationship. I want a woman that fights me. Hell no. life's tough enough.
Yeah, I don't fight enough.
Yeah, right. I'm like, yeah, I want it easy. Maybe you can call me a wimp. That's okay. I want it.
It's not even that. I don't want an instrument that's got problems to get in my way of playing music.
Sure. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So. It's like a piano player that say, I can't play this Steinway or whatever because it's stiffer than this other one, you know.
Hmm.
And was in the studio with Reese last month, and he was talking about he didn't want to go to this one studio because the piano was too hard to play. And this guy, I mean.
Yeah, he's played a million. Wonderful right. piano player. Wonderful right. keyboard
player. So you don't want an instrument to fight you, you know.
So you got your Squires, the white SG, and what would be the other one, the last one?
I've got this Collings acoustic that I'm crazy about, and I've got this Martin acoustic I'm crazy about. I've got an old Harmony acoustic I'm crazy about. I mean, I'm in love with my guitar.
You know that anytime you, I don't know if you're probably, I don't know if you're aware of this or not. Anytime all over the world, I talk to guitar players and if the issue comes up about a guitar, you are the example. Hey, Jack Pearson plays a Squire. I don't know if you're aware of that.
You know, people, well, yeah, I get emails and stuff and I see people on Facebook writing about it, you know, but I'm here to tell you. They are good guitars, or I wouldn't be playing them. You can't go by the price tag. They think I'm playing them because they're cheap or something, but
I
can't endorse them. You know, I mean, one time at the store, I had seven of them sitting around me, and there was two that were good. You know, so I got them. I gave one to a friend, and I kept the other one.
Sure.
Yeah, and so I'm glad they're inexpensive.
Sure.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, everybody can have a decent guitar to play. But, you know, they're made at a plant that makes guitars for all of the major companies. I don't know. A lot of people don't understand that. It's the plant in Indonesia. It's not the Korean ones or the Chinese. These that I like, they just all happen to be made in Indonesia. And so, I don't know. Maybe they were all made the same day.
Yeah, I don't know.
Who knows? Maybe it's just a... Maybe it was a good batch of wood, and they made 500 of them, you know.
Yeah. No one's going to sit and say you shouldn't play a Squire if they listen to you. I mean, that's just be ridiculous. So.
But, yeah, some people are making a big deal out of it, but I think they're fine guitars. The other guitar recently is, and I never thought I would like a guitar like this because I never liked them anytime I would play them, is a Flying V.
Interesting.
I was in the studio, and this case was open, and it was Joe Bottomassa, and I thought it was his old guitar, and I got up close to it, I thought, that's an Epiphone, you know. So I had to pick it up, and I picked it up. It was the same thing. It vibrates, and it's resonant. It's very loud. It's as loud as a 335 unplugged, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So are my little Squire Strats. They're loud acoustically.
Hmm.
So that's what I want. I want a guitar that's vibrating. So anyhow, I asked Joe about it. He said, yeah, man, I think they're about $800. They gave me a bunch of them. If you want this one, you can have it. So I said, thank you very much. And so he sent me a text a few days later. He saw a video of me playing it on Facebook. He's like, man, that tone. So what I've done is it's standard tuning, but I tune it down 3 frets. So see, the open E string is a C sharp, like Albert King.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's what Albert King did. He tuned it down to C sharp.
Well, you know, I used to think he must be so strong to bend those strings like he does, right? Because he was a big old guy. I remember opening a show for him in the '80s, and I tried to say hi to him, but he wasn't in a good mood that day, so I didn't bother him. And, but yeah, so this Live at the Fillmore shows up on YouTube. Albert, yeah. Man, that's some of the best playing and singing. Blues power.
Love it.
I get my guitar, you know, to play along with it, and the band's in G, and I see he's up there playing in the B flat position. Right. Hmm. So like, oh, okay. Well, I tune my guitar down. It's like all of a sudden I can bend the string around the neck, you know.
Plus he had it upside down. He had it upside down.
That doesn't even matter. It's the string tension. It's the reason he could bend. And it allows the string to vibrate a little different. And when you come down off of that string bend, it has that sound. And I never could get it quite like that before. Now, he used a different kind of tuning. The low strings were tuned funny, but I didn't want to get into that because I'm already dealing with about five or six open tunings for playing slide and blues.
Yeah, yeah.
So the open D, open G, E7th tuning, and a G6 tuning, and standard tuning. You know, I'm done with tunings. It's a lot to keep straight, you know.
It is.
Yeah.
What about music, if I asked you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order and knowing that this could change tomorrow, what would be the first three CDs that come to mind right now? Knee-jerk reaction.
Something by Django. My favorite collection right now is Django on the Radio. It's a bunch of recordings that the Army did, USO shows. And they surfaced, and they did, it's like five CDs. And, man, he's playing acoustic. He's playing electric with orchestras and big bands. He's playing bebop. He is tearing it up. He kicks this one tune off. It sounds like Purple Haze at the beginning. Gong, gank, gong, gank, gank, gong, gong. And he goes into this like a Latin thing, and then he goes all the way down from his high note. And the band comes in. I'm like, what? You know, I mean, he was just so amazing. So it would be some Django, probably Charlie Parker and probably Wes Montgomery, you know. But I love so much stuff. Gosh.
Who would you say your number one blues artist that you enjoy listening to? Blues guitar player.
Well, I can't just say one.
Okay, you can say more.
I can't, because, you know, it's like Mance Lipscomb, Blind Willie Johnson, Freddie Albert and B.B. and Albert Collins, you know.
Yeah.
It's just so many guys. Anybody that plays good, I dig it, you know? I try to learn from all of them. And then these other instruments, you know, because I'm dealing with mandolin tunings too, you know? And the banjo is tuned across. It's like an open C and an open G, and then there's some alterations on it. So it's a lot of tunings to try to keep straight. If I hadn't played one of them for a while, I'll pick it up. It's, you know, it takes me a few minutes to get going on it again.
Yeah, well, that makes you're juggling a ton of different stuff. It's got to be. That sounds pretty reasonable that it takes you a few minutes to get back to it.
But you know what? That keeps it fresh. It keeps it fresh. You know.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. When I was little, we'd go over to visit my dad's brother, Uncle Roy, and they had and Eunice, and they had a piano. So I'd always run to that room and start pecking on the piano, and we never had one. So when I was about 25, got married, we got a little bitty synthesizer, and I started teaching myself, you know, where the notes were on the keyboard, and I got into trying to play, you know, keyboards and stuff. And then I always loved the organ. My brother-in-law, John Downs, he played B3 and he knew Greg and Dwayne. He's the one that gave me Allman Brothers at Fillmore East. and he showed me how to do the chord movement on Stormy Monday.
Yeah, the transition.
The sixth chord and the ninth chord, and he showed me that. He showed me a diminished chord. He showed me that those minor nines and stuff, and he played enough guitar to do that. And he sat me down. And he said, "This is Dwayne in this speaker, and this is Dickie in this speaker, and you need to learn everything they played on this." And I did, but I also learned all that ZZ Top stuff and Steppenwolf and you name it. Yeah, Marshall Tucker. Oh man, I just love Toy Caldwell.
Toy Caldwell was a great guitar player. Yeah.
You know, and getting to play with some of those guys later on. Paul Riddle, the drummer, and I are good friends. And, you know, I don't know, just getting to grow up and meet some of these guys and be friends with them and play with them, and, you know.
I'm going to ask you two more questions because I want to be sensitive to time.
Okay.
Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I'm pretty sure they think I'm odd. Somebody said, "What do you do for a hobby when you're not playing guitar?" Of course, my answer is always, "I play mandolin or banjo." Or, you know, I used to love to ride my bicycle. I tore my knee up, so I hadn't been able to ride, and I'm hoping I can get back to that this year. Used to love to play racquetball and tennis. Board games and card games. We always played Rook and stuff growing up. I miss doing that, those kind of things. Seems like everybody's so busy nowadays. There's not many get-togethers.
Because of this, man.
I'm a workaholic.
Because of this.
Yeah, the phone. Yeah,
it's a problem. It's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got three email accounts and Facebook and the phone and the text and the home phone. I mean, it's a lot of stuff to wake up and think about. What do I check first?
Before you even get to work. I know. Right.
Before you even get out of the bed.
Yeah.
You know? And it's really been bothering me for a while. And so sometimes I just turn everything off and I'll sit here and play my guitar. You know?
Good for you. You mentioned earlier you got married. Are you still married?
No, I was married for 25 years and I've been single for 7.
One last
question. Right now I'm dating Gibson SG.
How's it going?
Good. You know, it doesn't argue with me when I play this B flat chord.
Last question, Jack, and I really appreciate your time. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of this change do you think has been deliberate, and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Well, you know, I have some physical problems. You know, I was in a car wreck, messed up my spine and back, and I have some arthritis. Things, you know, just getting older, you have to deal with it. I never used to have to warm up playing guitar. Now, if I don't do my finger stretches and things for a few minutes before I even pick up a guitar, you know, I can, the tendons really hurt. I don't want to get carpal tunnel, so I'm trying to be real careful about that. I think I'm more excited about playing. I feel more love for everybody than ever, you know. And I've got lifelong friends. Once you better watch out. You become friends with me, you can't get rid of me, you know. I've always been a pretty loyal guy, you know, so like I said, you know, I've stayed in bands way too long sometimes. You know, you just keep hoping you'll get discovered and you drive around in the car all everywhere, you know. But some points you just got to say it's time to do something else.
Yeah, I heard an expression. There's a difference between persistence and like blind, dumb persistence.
Yeah.
And I've been guilty of the second myself on occasion. So, yeah.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Yeah. There was one band I was in. I mean, we slugged it out for, you know, 15 years, I guess. Just never could get over the hump. Well, you know, but all this social media stuff really helps. I mean, I've gotten more attention in the last 3 years just because of YouTube and Facebook than ever. You know, I was telling Leroy a few months ago, I said, "You remember when we used to drive around and staple posters to telephone poles. You know, we couldn't get our name in the paper even if we'd have stole a bicycle.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it just, we couldn't get any attention back then. And we were good, man. That first band we had was smoking.
With Renegade.
I actually liked it better than the second band we had. I liked the first band better. It was something. But we played a lot of gigs, man, and there'd be two people in the audience. But we loved to play. And that was some of the best music never heard.
Well, man, you are a very talented guy and very deserving of recognition. And I just want to tell people, again, Jack's last name is Pearson. It's P-E-A-R-S-O-N. And he's got two records coming out soon. One's a live record, one's a studio R&B. And you got a really cool online lesson thing going called at jackpearsonguitar.com. So you want to just talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I've always done some private lessons and things, and I never was able to get a record deal or anything. They would usually say, you're not marketable or whatever. And, you know, but I continue to press up CDs on my own. Well, a few years ago, I kept thinking, I want to do an instructional thing, because that's another way of sharing the music, right? And so I went into business with my sister. She said she used to enjoy editing video when she was in college, and I never knew that. So a light bulb went off, and I said, boy, do I have something for you to do. So we bought some cameras and got a company here in Nashville to design the website. It took them 2 years to design the website. And we have a search engine. If you type in the word pick or finger style or dominant seventh chord or G minor, it'll bring up the videos that have those tags. So we try to tag each video. Some of them are short, some of them are long. So I even found myself just practicing, because people would ask me, how do you practice? Okay, I'll film myself practicing so you can see it. And
which is a great idea, I think, actually.
I think so.
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. No, I think it's a fun, because you know what? If you're not trained, you could practice all you want, but you might not. You watch a guy that is trained, that's a big, you know, it's a big difference. Practicing the right way and practicing if you don't know any better, all you know is what's in your head. But if you sit and, I think it's a very clever idea, actually.
I promise you, when I was a teenager, I remember thinking, I've got to stop practicing my mistakes.
Yeah.
Because I just kept running over these things, and it's like, there's got to be a better way to do this, a different fingering or something. And so I started thinking of, I've got to weed out these little bad habits in my playing, and that's how I started progressing. We've got 50 categories on there now.
That's awesome.
It's, you know, once you sign up for it, you get access to everything. And I tried to make it inexpensive for guitar players, because, you know, we usually don't have much money, but it's so much cheaper than private lessons.
What's the cost, Jack?
I think it's like $25 a month.
Good Lord.
And if you sign up for a year, you get 2 months free.
Man,
I mean, I just can't do it.
That's the best deal going. And it's at Jack Pearson Guitar.
Yeah, jackpearsonguitar.com. I really wanted it so everybody could have access to it. But it's still got to pay for itself.
Of course. Man, there's nothing wrong. This is a bad thing about musicians.
Yeah.
It's okay to make money, you know, and musicians struggle with that. But yeah, you should, man, you've got a unique skill, highly trained. Man, if you were a physician, you wouldn't be like justifying the cost of your $25,000. No, seriously, if you were a musician.
I know. I have a friend that's one of the best bone surgeons in the country. And I told him, I said, it's a shame musicians don't make what they, you know, whatever category their talent is.
Right. You know, he's not justifying why he's charging, you know, $25,000 for a procedure. And man, you don't have to if you want to play guitar and you can't afford $25 a month, just sit on the free stuff, because you'll never learn from a guy like Jack. Because I've checked it out. It's incredible. All the videos are really smooth, well filmed. It's very genuine. It's not, I mean, look, people could listen to this. You're not a guy that dicks around. You're like very serious about your guitar. You get right to it. You're not going to give them fluff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you've been around, man.
You know, I filmed this one series, and it's my favorite licks, is what we're calling it. And we're adding stuff to it all the time. But, you know, I mean, it's some very personal licks of mine that I've been playing all of my life, and they've stuck with me. And I try to break it down as much as you can. You know, some of this stuff you can't slow down. I can't, you know. You just kind of have to do it. Of course, there's, you know, I think the computer can do some of that. But anyhow, I just tell people, you know, if you can give up 2 fajitas a month, yeah, you can jump the site,
yeah,
right?
Hell so, yeah. So everybody, yeah, just check it out. Go to Jack Pearson Guitar. It's P-E-A-R-S-O-N, jackpearsonguitar.com, and there is no better bang for your buck. That being said, man, I cannot thank you enough for your time. I really appreciate it. I've been trying to get a hold of you, and I'm really glad I got to connect, and thank you very much. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Jack does not spend a lot of time doing these, so I really am very grateful. And thanks again to Jack Pearson for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. Check him out online at Jack Pearson Guitar. Again, it's P-E-A-R-S-O-N. And go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with early product announcements and discounts. Most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so make some good choices out there, man. Be nice, go play a guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, and I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.